There's this feeling that I've been trying to describe for a while now, and I don't think I've ever quite nailed it. It's not depression or anxiety, though it does have elements of both of those things. So I would say this is more like a kind of flatness that settles in after you've spent, too many days completely indoors, entirely under fluorescent or artificial light of some kind, looking at screens most of the time. And if you were to describe that exact environment to someone 100 years ago, they'd likely assume that you were describing a punishment, right? So it's like there's something in you that goes slightly offline or something, and your concentration starts drifting for no particular reason. And then you finally reach this point where it's like the air in the room just feels used up. And you have this tiredness, in a way that even a solid good night's sleep doesn't really fix. So naturally, you reach for your phone to fix the phone problem with the phone. And I think most people, when they feel this way, they just, they assume that it's something like stress or burnout. And they think they just need to drink more water and take more vitamins or, I don't know, download a new app or something. And sure, maybe some of that helps around the edges, but I think that there is actually something more to this going on underneath the surface that doesn't really get talked about. And there's a name for it. It's called nature deficit disorder, which was coined by a journalist and an author named Richard Louv back in 2005. Now, this isn't an official clinical diagnosis or anything, though I think it probably should be. This is more like a description of something that is real, but most clinical language just doesn't reach, I guess. So, in a nutshell, nature deficit disorder is it's basically the human cost of alienating ourselves from nature. And now what I find interesting and unsettling about this is just how far that cost actually goes. Because it turns out that we've been running an experiment on ourselves since the Industrial Revolution. And the experiment is what happens to a species that evolved outside, mostly outdoors over hundreds of thousands of years, and then just gets moved almost entirely inside overnight. Well, which should come as a surprise to nobody. It turns out that when you move a species that has lived for or spent like 300,000 years outdoors into an environment, with a fluorescent lit box, and then you expect it to actually thrive in that environment. This was maybe not the most thoroughly considered plan we've ever had as a civilization. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? So, yeah, as you might expect, the results are not exactly great. Actually, the results are pretty horrible because, well, here we are, 200 years into this experiment, And the findings are pretty much as follows. We've got ubiquitous chronic anxiety, mass depression, isolation. We've got an epidemic of loneliness. And of course, let's not forget the multi-billion dollar industry selling people back, you know, selling people back like a PAL simulation of the thing that was taken from them. But hey, at least now you can buy a blue light filter that makes your screen slightly less like staring into a nuclear reactor. Problem solved, right? So Louv's book called The Last Child in the Woods came out in 2005. And I would say that this was probably the first time that anybody had really pulled together the research on this in a way that, you know, the typical person could actually read without a graduate degree or a Mensa membership. Now, so his initial focus was actually on the kids' perspective. In particular, the generations that grew up indoors who were overscheduled and, you know, constantly in front of screens. And of course, who were never left alone outside for any meaningful stretch of time. Which, if you grew up in the 70s and 80s, like I did, probably sounds insane. I mean, we were rather feral back then. We basically disappeared after breakfast and came back when it got dark. And nobody called the FBI or anything. So in any case, that was just how things were back in the dark ages before the internet. But Louv was pretty clear from the beginning that this wasn't just a kid's problem. The whole argument was that things like, you know, urbanization and car culture and, well, not to mention the liability culture that we have now where letting your kid climb a tree apparently became legally inadvisable. And then combine all that with the overscheduled lives and the constant screen time. All of this stuff had pretty much eliminated casual contact with nature for most people. In the modern industrialized nations, anyway. And this didn't happen in some dramatic way or anything. It happened gradually until one day you look up and you realize that the last time that you were truly outside, you know, actually in the woods, not just walking to and from your car in a parking lot or standing on a patio holding your phone. The last time that happened was long enough ago where you don't even remember when that was. So what nature deficit disorder produces, according to Louv, are things like diminished use of the senses, attention difficulties, ADHD, anyone? Higher rates of physical and emotional illness, which of course covers a lot of different health problems. There's also rising myopia, there's vitamin D deficiency. And none of these things sounds especially catastrophic in isolation. But, you know, when you start to put them together, it paints a picture of a species which is, technically speaking, not exactly doing great. And so, how do we respond to this? Well, we respond by buying more supplements. We buy more stuff to put in our bodies because we live in a consumerist system that preaches the doctrine of endless growth. And we download wellness apps of some type or other, which is kind of like responding to scurvy by purchasing a more expensive pillow instead of just, you know, buying some fruits and vegetables. Yeah. So kids in this day and age now spend about half as much time outside as they did, as kids did 20 years ago. Half. And the adults that those kids became are raising the next generation pretty much under the same conditions, but probably even worse. So the deficit compounds. And every generation starts from a lower baseline. And we just keep calling wherever we land as normal. You know, this is the new normal. Which I suppose works until it doesn't, because that's not sustainable, right? So the thing that the Louvre kept returning to is that time and nature isn't a luxury. It's not the reward that you get after finishing your work or hitting your step count or, you know, completing whatever wellness protocol you're currently half-heartedly attempting. Nature is actually a biological requirement. And it's one that we've been eliminating from human life for at least the last couple of centuries. And then we wonder why so many people feel so terrible or at the very least unwell in some sort of way that they can't quite put their finger on. So the Japanese, who have been paying attention to this a little longer than we have, they developed something in the 1980s called Shinri-yoku, which translates to forest bathing. Now, I realize that that probably sounds like something you'd find on a spa menu between the hot stone massage and the herbal wrap. Though honestly, I don't even know what an herbal wrap is. It just sounds like it might taste good. Anyway, so the Japanese have been studying this for 40-something years, and their findings are actually rather surprising. So there were about 20 studies done, and there were over 2,000 participants. And the consistent result across, I mean, this is across multiple countries and different populations, was that spending time in a forest or the woods or what have you, even just standing there, not hiking or running through it or anything like that, just being there, measurably reduces anxiety and depression and your cortisol levels and blood pressure. So basically the takeaway here is that the human nervous system, when it's placed in the woods, does something that apparently it can't do anywhere else. It calms down. And then there's the attention research, which I find almost more disturbing than the depression stuff because, well, here's why. So researchers at the University of Illinois discovered that even just brief exposure to natural environments improves concentration and it reduces ADHD symptoms, sometimes comparably to medication. So the brain has what they call an attention restoration mode, which this mode only activates when you're in natural settings. This is like, it's a kind of effortless replenishment that you can't get from sitting at a desk. And you're not going to get it from looking at a screen. Nor is it going to be replicated by, a nature documentary or a Forest Sounds app, which, yes, is a real product that exists and people are buying. So, all right, just to summarize here for a minute, we removed something from the human environment that was apparently essential for basic cognitive and emotional function and essential for our well-being. And then we replicated it with buildings, with fluorescent lighting and bad air and a subscription service of some kind, which eventually led to an epidemic of attention disorders and depression and other health issues that people started taking medication for. And I'm not necessarily implying that medication doesn't work for some people. It's just that I guess what I'm saying is maybe we should also consider the part where, we took away the trees. Where we severed ourselves from nature. And then this next thing really got me. So, the same University of Illinois research found that housing project residents with green space nearby, they had measurably lower rates of violent outbursts than housing developments without any green space nearby. And the variable, it wasn't about income, it wasn't population density, it was whether there were trees. That's right. So apparently the hippies were right. Tree hugging is good for you. And it appears that we've been having this incredibly expensive and painful national conversation about violence for I don't know how many decades now. And apparently, part of the answer or solution, I guess, was just touching grass. Who'd have thunk? But of course, nobody wants to hear that. Because it doesn't fit neatly into any political narrative. And the pharmaceutical industry sure as hell doesn't want you knowing this for obvious reasons. So I guess here's where I would normally say something reassuring, like, but we're aware of the problem now, so that's something. Except, we're not really doing anything about it, the problem. So, I mean, if anything, we're doing the opposite by clearing green spaces to build more data centers. Wonderful. The thing is, all right, more than half of the world's population now lives in cities. And urban design, with some honorable exceptions, has been systematically removing the kind of incidental nature contract that, or contact that used to just happen as a byproduct of just being alive. So that creek where you used to mess around as a kid, got replaced with, I don't know, like a parking structure, let's say. And, that vacant lot that was basically a wilderness if you were 8 years old and you had any imagination, that got replaced by like a lifestyle center, which, as far as I can tell, is just a mall that's embarrassed about what it is. And then there's what Louvre called the liability culture, which I mentioned briefly earlier. So at some point in the last few decades, letting your kid climb a tree became the kind of thing that could actually get you a visit from Child Protective Services, which to me sounds insane. So, what did schools do? Well, they started paving over fields and, taking down trees, and removing anything that had any even remote chance of leading to litigation. Because, grass requires maintenance and trees can cause problems, and somebody might sprain their ankle or something, and somebody else might sue. And also, you may have noticed, I mean, at least I've noticed this, that when you go to a public park these days, there's signs at the park now that have this long list of rules about what you're not allowed to do anymore, which in some cases is basically everything, except stand there and look at your phone. That's ironically, that's perfectly fine. And so the result of this is we have a generation of kids who've never experienced any unsupervised outdoor time as a normal condition of childhood. I mean, this doesn't even get registered as a loss in our society. It's just, I guess it's just the water that they swim in now, or I guess more accurately, it's the air conditioning they sit in. So I grew up in the 70s and the 80s where we were outside constantly, and it wasn't because our parents were enlightened about child development or anything. It was mostly because they just wanted us to get the hell out of the house. And that accidental, unstructured, nobody's watching time in the woods, in the creek, or wherever, that turns out to have actually been doing something important. That no amount of scheduled outdoor enrichment activities with a certified facilitator is gonna replace. Because you can't program feral. It doesn't work that way, trust me. Someone's tried, and now there's a curriculum for it, apparently. And of course, there is also the screen issue, which we've covered before, so I won't drag this out. But the math is pretty simple here. So every hour that you are on a device, that's usually an hour where you're not outside. The average kid in the US is spending somewhere between, oh, I think it was 4 and 7 hours a day in front of a screen. And the adults, of course, aren't doing much better. So, that being said, the phone, of course, comes outside with us anyway, which means that even when we're technically outside, we are mostly just indoors in a different location. So basically it's the same doom scroll just with fresh air, right? And the cumulative effect of all of this is that this is now a world where contact with nature requires like deliberate effort and planning, equipment. Now you got to buy the right clothing to go outside, be outdoors, and transportation. And of course, you need the free time. And obviously, all of this simultaneously on a random weekday when most people are already running on empty. which means that it just doesn't happen for most people. And so the deficit compounds. And we call whatever we're left with normal. Again, the new normal, which I guess that word is doing a lot of heavy lifting these days. So here's the thing that I keep thinking about. Every statistic, every study, every peer-reviewed finding about what nature does to the human nervous system, all of it is essentially science catching up to something that virtually every human culture before ours already knew on some level. And not as a theory, just as this is just as the basic operating assumption of being alive. So the Lakota people, they have a concept that's called Mitakuye Oyasin, which translates roughly to all my relations. And I want to acknowledge that I'm doing my best with that pronunciation out of respect for the language. Lakota has some sounds that English doesn't really have. So if I got that wrong, I apologize to any of my Lakota friends in the audience, if there are any. So basically, what Itakuye Oyasin describes is it's a worldview it's a worldview in which humans are not separate from and not superior to nature, but we're embedded in it. Or part of it. So I guess you could say it's something like being a part of a web of kinship, which includes animals and plants and rivers and just the land itself. And the part of this that I think tends to get left out when Western culture borrows indigenous concepts for wellness content, is it comes with obligations. So if you take from the land, you give back. You harvest and you tend. So there's a reciprocal relationship there. And without this relationship, it really is just extraction. It's extraction that's wearing the clothes of a relationship. And I think that this is actually a pretty accurate description of how we currently treat nature. It's just a process of extraction that's wearing the clothes of appreciation. Though I would wager that those clothes are looking pretty damn shoddy at this point. So I suppose this brings me to some other worldviews that I think might be of interest here when talking about this sort of thing. One of which is known as animism. So this is probably the oldest human worldview on the planet, actually. And animism has been found independently across pretty much every indigenous culture around the planet. So this idea basically holds that everything has consciousness, whether it's animals, plants, rivers, rocks, the weather, and so forth. And not metaphorically, actual consciousness. And now, before you file that under, primitive superstition or something, I do think it is worth knowing that there are actually some contemporary philosophers and even some cognitive scientists who are these days, they're taking animism more seriously as a legitimate description of how the human mind evolved to perceive the world. Because we didn't evolve in a world of objects. We evolved in a world that was alive around us. And the brain apparently still expects that, and it still reaches for it, which might explain why, being in a forest feels the way it does, and why being in a fluorescent lit open space or open plan office feels the way that does too. So another worldview that I want to mention here is the Gaia hypothesis, which was developed in the 1970s by a NASA scientist named James Lovelock and a microbiologist named Lynn Margulis. So the idea here is that the Earth itself it functions as like a single self-regulating living system. And the conditions that are necessary for life aren't just presented on the earth. They're actually maintained by the sum total of living things interacting with the atmosphere and the oceans and the soil. So the planet isn't really a rock with life on it. It's more like, well, think of it more like a living theme that happens to have a rock in the middle. And if that's true, and the science does increasingly suggest that it is, then the human disconnection from nature, it isn't just bad for humans. It's a pretty big disruption in something planetary in scale that we depend on completely. But we only partially understand. Which, this is a fun thing to think about at 2:30 in the morning when you have insomnia. And then there is another worldview that I think we should mention, which is known as deep ecology, which was also developed in the 1970s by Arne Naess, a Norwegian philosopher and a mountaineer who spent a number of years living alone in a cabin in the mountains, where he wrote about this. So the distinction that he drew was between the shallow environmentalism, which protects nature because it's useful to humans. And I guess as opposed to the concept of deep ecology, which states that nature actually has intrinsic value that's independent of what it does for us. So it doesn't need to earn its existence by being useful to us. We are not the point here. And that's either liberating or I guess threatening, depending on how attached you are to being the point, I guess. And I guess this makes me think of another thing. I think it was Henry David Thoreau, who also lived alone in a cabin for a while, who came to the conclusion, or had this kind of, I guess, realization that most of what he thought he needed, he didn't. And most of what he actually needed, he had been ignoring, which, pretty much sums up our whole situation here with our issue here with nature, our separation from it. And of course, nowadays, that statement is still true. And for the most part, we still haven't really done anything about it. All right. So, Florence Williams, who wrote a book called The Nature Fix in 2017, traveled to Japan and Finland and South Korea specifically to study why nature makes us feel better. And so her conclusion was that you really only need about 20 minutes in a green space to reduce cortisol. And if you happen to be in the hospital and you're lucky enough to have a window with a view of trees right outside your window, that can actually measurably improve your recovery rate. But you have to actually be there. That's the thing. Your actual body in actual nature without the phone mediating the experience, because the screen isn't, it's not going to do what the real thing does. The brain's not fooled by the simulation, which I understand is probably inconvenient for a lot of people, but there you have it. And I guess what stays with me after all of this, the indigenous worldviews and the philosophers and the researchers with their cortisol measurements and whatnot, is that none of them were talking to each other throughout any of this. But nonetheless, they all pretty much ended up in the same place. And I don't think that that's an accident. Because, humans have been treating this like it's a weekend, a hobby or something, something to get around to when things calm down. But things don't ever really calm down, do they? I mean, we know this. So even though this is at this point, this is kind of a cliche, I'm going to say it anyways. Touch some damn grass. That's the takeaway here. And I mean that literally without any irony, which is probably strange to say, given the thumbnail, but whatever. Just go outside if you can. Leave the phone inside if you can manage it. And I realize that's asking a lot these days. Find a nice tree. Stand near it, maybe give it a hug. Let whatever happens happen. Even if you have to pee on the tree. I don't know. And look, this isn't going to fix everything. This isn't supposed to be some empty platitude here. But it costs nothing. And it might be the most basic countercultural act available to you right now, believe it or not. Which I would say, given where where we are currently, feels at least to me like it's enough of a reason. So, yeah, nature, essential. And I actually do get out to nature quite a lot, even though I realize people probably think I'm some kind of hermit. But it's probably the one place that really, where I really feel my best, where I really feel the most centered. I suppose at this point, that's all I have to say on that. Thanks so much for listening.